Let's do a little bit of review so we can appreciate what we're going to be talking about today and put it in its historical context, the flow of Western thought. At the end of the Enlightenment, man's autonomous reason, he had taken great pride in his being a law to himself, being cut free from divine revelation, and he's going to understand the world, you know, with unfettered reason. Man's self-sufficiency brought him to a point of despair and skepticism. And so the first thing I'm going to put on the board, just as a reminder, the names of Hume and Kant. And I'm going to put them up here at the top in the middle. And then I want to diagram how things flow from them. Hume, remember, is the philosopher aiming to be consistently empirical, who realized that if you just go on the basis of your disjointed perceptions, there is no foundation for science, there is no foundation for ethics. So Hume ends in skepticism. Kant tries to mitigate that skepticism, but he ends up in metaphysical agnosticism. Okay, we can't know anything about the nature of ultimate reality. We can only know how things appear to us. Our mind works over the input of the senses and forms phenomena for us that's intelligible. But it's intelligible not because things out there as they really are intelligible, but because the mind has created that situation. So in Hume, we have skepticism, in Kant, metaphysical agnosticism. Now, I've tried to make the 19th century understandable to you by suggesting that there are three streams, if you will, flowing out of Hume and Kant, or three different ways that philosophers and culture have responded to Hume and Kant. The first one I'll draw is the stream coming directly out of Kant, because he was an idealist of sorts, and Hegel was an idealist as well, but they certainly had their differences, the primary one being that Hegel did not buy the noumenal-phenomenal distinction. Hegel felt that you can come to know things as they really are. In fact, the thing, it's not a thing though, it's a subject, as it really is. Hegel said you can come to know absolute spirit through a form of reasoning that's more sophisticated than what the Enlightenment thinkers had in mind. And so this first stream in 19th century philosophy that comes out of Hume's skepticism and Kant's metaphysical agnosticism is rationalism, or maybe even supra-rationalism, because it's this refurbished kind of rationalism. So I'll write rationalism coming down this road or stream. There were many problems with Hegel, not the least of which is on his attempt to refurbish rationalism, all the truths which we now call truth are only partial, and they're relativized by their context and their place in historical development. So we don't ever have the absolute truth. To have the absolute truth, you'd have to be at the end of history and know everything. Or as some critics have put it, under Hegel, to know anything, you have to know everything. You'd have to be at the end of the process. Until you get to the end of the process, your reason is stuck with only partial truths. And so this doesn't seem like it really has gotten away from Hume and Kant and the lack of certainty that was introduced with them. The stream of thought that we have been studying after Hegel, I have called the alternative access approach. I'm going to give you a new way of designating it today, so you're going to grow up a bit in your self-consciousness now, to be Hegelian in my way of putting it.
The alternative access approach says that you can know, or we can know, or have some kind of encounter with ultimate reality. We're not cut off from it, but it's going to be an alternative route. It's not going to be the route of reasoning or rationalism. And what ties all these various options together is what we will now call non-cognitivism. They're called non-cognitive because the access that we have to ultimate reality is not through our thinking, not through our cognition. In fact, these approaches in 19th century philosophy were very skeptical of man's cognition. Either it doesn't have a great deal of power, or it's positively distorting, or it's simply a tool to try to control other people. It is not something that gets you to the objective truth. So the non-cognitivists have something in common with Kant, don't they? Because though they believe you can have contact with the ultimate reality, they don't think you can have any rational understanding. You can't make ultimate reality intelligible in the sense that autonomous reason was supposed to do in the Enlightenment. And the first example of non-cognitivism down the road we look at is voluntarism. Here we have Arthur Schopenhauer's blind will that is behind everything. And we know this by intuition. So this is not a cognitive approach to philosophy. We intuit ultimate reality to be blind will. And then we looked at romanticism. The romantics said that man needs to get in touch with his feelings, with his imagination, if you will. And we have a direct, empathetic savoring of the nature of reality. And so we do know something about the ultimate real, this large real thing that is our experience, but we don't know it rationally. Rationalism destroys experience, cuts it up into little pieces. You do better to just savor the steak rather than to ask a scientist to tell you about its chemical components and so forth. If you want to know reality, get in touch with your feelings. And then this led to what I have called subjective individualism with Soren Kierkegaard. Yeah, you can all make my day. Kierkegaard said that the main question in philosophy is not what is ultimately true for my reason, but what should I do exactly. And so for Kierkegaard, who is your proto-existentialist, it's action and doing, or if you will, commitment, that is the most important thing in philosophy. Again, you see the non-cognitive character of this. In the end, we don't want a Hegelian rational system that is really irrelevant to what life is all about. Kierkegaard says, let's get away from all of this reasoning and let's commit our lives to the right things. Let's get a focus or a center for our lives. Now, if you're watching this progression down the road of non-cognitivism, I find it interesting, and maybe it makes it easy to remember too. What you have is different aspects of human reality being pushed up to the primary position, right? What's supreme for Schopenhauer? Will. What's supreme for the Romantics? Feeling. What's supreme for Kierkegaard? Commitment. Doing. Well, today, as we continue this series of lectures on the 19th century, we come to the end of the non-cognitivist road with the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche, which is often called nihilism. We're going to work to the place in the lecture where you can see this in its context, but because I have it up on the board, I want you to know that Friedrich Nietzsche is so nihilistic with respect to objective truth that he says that the falsity of a proposition is no objection to it. That's what I want you to remember. I mean, everything else will be good to remember too, but this is the major point. The falsity of a proposition is no objection to it. We'll come back to this and be reminded of it again. But so right now, at the outset of our lecture, how impressed are we with 19th century philosophy? How are things going? If you take the rational route, you have to know everything to know anything, so nobody can have the absolute truth now. If you take the non-cognitivist route, where does it end up? As we go through the various bumps on the road, you know, through will and emotion and commitment, we finally end up with the view that truth is not important at all. So at the end of this road, truth doesn't matter. At the end of this road, absolute truth is not available to us in the process of history. We're still working it out, as it were. And then I'm going to add another stream to this after we finish Nietzsche that we'll call secularism or phenomenalism, but I'll explain that when we come to it. So Friedrich Nietzsche, his dates are 1844 to 1900. I think that was very thoughtful of him to die right at 1900, so he is, you know, the bookend, if you will, of 19th century philosophy. That works out nicely. Nietzsche was a radical thinker with a great gift for prose styling. He really did have the ability to express things in a highly stylistic and memorable way. Nietzsche said that the time had come where it was now necessary to philosophize with a hammer. It's a nice little motto, pardon me, to remember him by. To philosophize with a hammer. He's a radical, hammering philosopher who had a gift for expression. Nietzsche was the son of a Lutheran pastor. He went to study at the universities of Bonn and Leipzig. He was an outstanding student, a brilliant student, who at the age of 24 was appointed professor of classics, in fact, professor of classical philology at the University of Basel. He was appointed professor before he had finished his doctoral work at the age of 24. So even though I hope you'll come to despise his philosophy, you have to admit he was an impressive young man, an impressive intellect. Mm-hmm. He was friends for a portion of his life with Richard Wagner. They later had a falling out. Nietzsche had recurring illnesses, many thought to be psychosomatic at this point. He spent a portion of his time after leaving his university teaching position because of illness, a portion of his time traveling in Italy and Switzerland and France. And then in January of 1889, he collapsed on a street in the city of Turin, France. And from that point on, was insane. Most likely from syphilis. The reputation of Nietzsche, he was nursed for the last years of his life by his sister. And as I indicated, died in 1900. He has a reputation for being an impressive aphorist. Now, who else have we studied that seemed to have a gift for literary aphorism? You recall? Schopenhauer. Nietzsche likewise, but even more impressively than Schopenhauer, was an aphorist. When he wrote his philosophy, remember, hammering away, he didn't show a great deal of restraint and fitting into protocol. He very boldly displayed his personal obsessions in his philosophy. The tone of his writing is quite intimate. You can see megalomania in his writing, and, well, the nature of his thought, you know, would lead to that sort of thing, but it's real obvious. He doesn't hold back. It's a very, well, there's real mood swings in his writing. You can really see that he's up and he's down, he's critical, he's affirmative, that sort of thing. And he is one of the greatest of Europe's essayists. Even to this day, people would have to give him credit for that. Nietzsche anticipated the theories of Freud. He wrote in an inflammatory way, being one of the German opponents of the liberal establishment. The ideals of liberalism Nietzsche was ready to hammer against. He was contemptuous of democracy, favored the aristocratic ideal. He was inflammatory in his atheism, inflammatory in his attacks on Christian and utilitarian ethics, inflammatory in his stress on the unconscious, voluntaristic, and orgiastic, self-destructive side of human nature. He was outlandish in his chauvinism toward women. Though we've mentioned something of the life of Nietzsche and his reputation, I can't mention all of his works, but you may want to be aware of these that I will bother to tell you of. The Birth of Tragedy, 1872. The Birth of Tragedy. Before I mention these other titles, I want you to know a little bit about that. We can't do an entire lecture on it, but a little nutshell summary. According to Nietzsche, if you look at tragedy, if you do an analysis of literature, you find that there are two different types of literature. There is the Apollonian literature, A-P-O-L-L-O-N-I-A-N, after the image of Apollo. And then there's the Dionysian type of literature, or pole in literature, after the Greek, ancient Greek image of Dionysius. Apollonian literature is characterized by order and balance. Dionysian literature, as you could probably guess, is characterized by passion and ecstasy and even repulsiveness. So on the one hand, you have the pole of protocol and order and balance. On the other hand, you have this all-out, passionate, ecstatic, even repulsive approach in literature. These are the different poles in art. According to Nietzsche, in The Birth of Tragedy, the Apollonian pole in art is nothing but the dream of rationality. We try to be balanced, we try to be orderly, but that's just a dream. It's the Dionysian pole that tears away the veil from the appearance and shows us the nihilism of life. There is no order. There is no rationality. There's passion. There's ecstasy. Okay, so that's one of his first publications, The Birth of Tragedy. He's known also for his work, Human, All Too Human, 1878. Beyond Good and Evil, 1886. Toward a Genealogy of Morals, 1887. And then his last work, which we may find interesting, The Antichrist, 1895. I assure you it was not his interest to try to do a chronology of Christ's return and identify the person in history who is the Antichrist. Nietzsche is the Antichrist. I'm sorry? Okay. Nietzsche was ahead of his day in many ways in what he presented. He had a really pioneering anticipation of what would later be psychoanalysis developed by Freud and Jung. He introduced the notions of repression, sublimation, and the thesis that there are mythical elements in all of science, which is what the later psychoanalyst said. Nietzsche said it first. He derogated human consciousness because it represses spontaneity. Consciousness gets in the way of being a spontaneous Dionysian, right? Individual. Nietzsche believed that all cultural phenomena express deep and unconscious elements of man's psyche. So everything that we might look at in culture, from our political institutions to our, in our day, rock music or rap music, whatever it is, what's up on the stage, the kind of painting, the kind of architecture we have, all of that is expressing from our culture deep psychic unconscious forces. Well, you've heard that kind of thing and seen it portrayed so many ways that you know, that's ho-hum to you. But it was Nietzsche who first proposed these sorts of things, later being picked up by the psychoanalyst. He was also pioneering in his realization that it's an analysis of language that's at the center of philosophy. In the 20th century, that anticipates a fundamental starting point or insight of Heidegger, the existentialist, of the logical positivist, of the later Wittgenstein, of the structuralist, and in our own generation, the deconstructionist, all of whom say that philosophy begins with an analysis of language. Well, it's Nietzsche who originally, you know, put language at the center that way. Well, that's not, you know, too shabby when you think about it. Here's somebody who can anticipate and give the starting point for psychoanalysis on the one hand and language philosophies on the other hand. So Nietzsche was quite a man. He died insane of syphilis. What am I doing here? Am I being Hegelian? I'm saying, well, there's this. He has this greatness about him as an intellect. He was a brilliant student, and yet his life was just such a mess. Who's the real Nietzsche here? Would Nietzsche or would Kierkegaard appreciate my approaching it in that way, trying to ask that kind of question? Of course not. Because what am I doing? I'm trying to be rational. I'm trying to find a balanced assessment of Nietzsche. Can't be done. Like Kierkegaard, Nietzsche finds man alone in an irrational, purposeless world. But the solution to that existential dilemma is the very opposite of Kierkegaard's. Okay, so as we're going down this road of non-cognitivism, subjective individualism, kind of a proto-existentialism, says you're alone, you're in a purposeless world, what's the focus of your life, what's going to give it meaning? Kierkegaard takes a religious, well, I say that broadly, I don't really think Kierkegaard had Orthodox Christianity in his veins, but he takes a religious approach by saying you have to have a leap of faith, be committed, passionately committed, but it's a leap of faith, and subordinate yourself to the other, here in capital letters, the other, God. Whereas Nietzsche, just the opposite, says God is dead. There is no absolute value or values to guide our lives. And he presents this in a number of works, but perhaps the best known work of Nietzsche, I haven't mentioned in the bibliography earlier, is Thus Spake Zarathustra, 1883 to 1891. published over those years. Thus spake Zarathustra. God is dead. That's the starting point of Nietzsche's passionate subjective individualism. Unlike Kierkegaard, who wanted to make the leap of faith and follow at any cost the call of God, even though it was absurd, remember? Nietzsche here says, God is dead, there are no absolute values to guide our lives, and the rare individual who's strong enough to face that truth and create values for himself is, and this is a difficulty now, how do we fill in the blank? He is the Übermensch in German, really, the overman. The overman, the man who is higher than, who is risen above. And in the early days of English translations, that was translated the Superman. Well, back before the comic strip and the television program and movies, you might have gotten away with that. Even that's pretty general. But we can't today say that because everybody thinks about, you know, the guy who is weakened by kryptonite and that kind of thing. Nietzsche wasn't the originator of the Superman series. He said, but the man who can face up to the purposelessness of this world, that there is no God, and the man who creates values for himself is the one who has risen above. He's the man who has exceeded. He's the overman, the Übermensch. Other men, by sharp contrast, slavishly conform to the ethic of their society rather than engaging in self-affirmation. And so Nietzsche had contempt for the ethics of Christ, Plato, Immanuel Kant, and he especially had contempt for the cowardly leap of faith of a Kierkegaard. All other men who will not be the Superman, the overman, all other men who will not rise above that, create values for themselves and affirm themselves, have a slave mentality. According to Nietzsche, it's Christianity's endorsement of humility and self-denial, Christianity's preference of soul over body, that has led to the mediocrity of Europe. If you deny yourself, then you're going to have a mediocre life. You need to affirm yourself. You need to create values for yourself. You need to become the Superman, the Overman. Okay, I've given you a taste of Nietzsche's philosophy, where he's going, what his life was like, the kind of reputation he had. Let me kind of develop this more systematically for you. First of all, you need to note that being trained in philology, you know, being an expert in language and the reconstruction of ancient texts and their interpretation, Nietzsche applied his work as a philologist to what we do in philosophy as a whole. He said, in philosophy, just like in philology, we never encounter original objects. Now, what do we mean by that? The philologist doesn't have the original writing of Plato or Socrates, whichever. He's got to go to manuscript copies, and he's got to reconstruct the original from all these manuscript copies. But now if you stop and think about it, the manuscript copies are themselves an interpretation of the original text, aren't they? Nietzsche is being accurate here. We tend to have a rather naive idea that, no, your eye looks at, the first copyist looked at the text, and then his hand just wrote what his eye saw. Well, but if that were true, if it was just that mechanical, we'd never have to compare text because of differences, would we? Interpretation enters even the copying process. When a copyist sees something that doesn't make perfectly good sense to him, or a word that's apparently misspelled, what does the copyist do? He corrects it, right? Well, but to correct the misspelling, or to smooth out something that doesn't seem grammatical, or to provide a proper translation of an idiom, that all depends on what? The copyist knowing how to spell the word, or being correct that that word was what he thought it was. I mean, maybe in the ancient text, what he has here is not a misspelled word, but a word he's never seen before. And the original author intended it to be that way. So I'm only giving you that as an illustration that all copying involves interpretation. And so Nietzsche said about the cognitive process, we need to realize we never encounter original objects in this world. What we encounter in this world is always constructs of reality, not reality itself. That is, everything in our experience is interpretation, and therefore subjective. You can see the heritage of Kant, can't you? Kant says we never get to the things in themselves, or if you will, the original objects, the original text. All we have is phenomena, interpretation of the original text. And so Nietzsche had a perspectivist theory of truth. A perspectivist theory of truth, and advanced what we today call the sociology of knowledge, that all knowledge is governed by social factors and determinants. A perspectivist theory of truth and a sociology of knowledge. He wrote, against positivism, which halts at phenomena, saying there are only facts, I would say, no, facts are precisely what there are not, only interpretations. Okay. In a little while, we'll look at what he was referring to as positivism. The positivist says, let's not interpret, let's just take the facts as we find them. Nietzsche says, that's exactly what we don't have. There are no facts. There is no original text. There's only interpretation. And so he raised questions with regard to the sociology of knowledge about the relation between the truth of a doctrine and its historical genesis and its social application. So with respect to the cognitive process, Nietzsche says we don't get original text, we only get interpretation. Secondly, Nietzsche said that the theories of the philosophers are all and only elaborate attempts to rationalize what they believe ahead of time on instinct. Some of the funnest reading in Nietzsche, in his aphorisms, are the way he hammers the philosophers. And one of the most dreadful metaphors he uses, he calls them lawyers. They're all just appointed attorneys or hired attorneys. Ooh, ouch. Forget this objective, balanced search for the truth wherever it may be. No, they've got a conclusion they're trying to push, and it's like they've been hired, you know, to argue this particular case. They're just rationalizing their own prejudices. Well, he can be a little over the top when he says these things. I mean, he really goes after the philosophers, despises them. But, you know, as a presuppositionalist, I read a lot of that, and I say, you know, there's real insight here, too. It may be pushed too hard, and he may not be self-critical, you know, thinking of his own prejudices, But the fact is, philosophers are prejudiced people. And Nietzsche was willing in his boldness. I mean, he didn't hold anything back. He came out and he hammered the philosophers too. He said the very way in which philosophers reason, that is, the standards that they use and what they choose as relevant evidence, the very way that they reason reflects their preconceptions and therefore their instincts. Some people would say, well, no, philosophers may come with their preconceived ideas, but we all enter the arena of the university or of rationality or of debate, and we follow the rules and we find out who had the best evidence. Nietzsche said, no, it isn't that way at all, because what you consider the rules of engagement are also a reflection of your prejudices. Remember, everything's interpretation. And so when you get to the university and somebody says, okay, I challenge you, we'll go debate that, and here's how the debate's going to, you know, take place, Nietzsche says, notice that by setting up rules of debate in that nature, you're already showing your commitment to a certain version of human nature and rationality and cognitive process. That is, you're begging the question from the very outset. And here, this is a brilliant insight. It's one which many Christian apologists could learn from. We had this idea that, well, some people have the hypothesis that the Bible's true, that God exists, that Jesus is the Son of God. Other people don't have that hypothesis. And what we do is we go and make an impartial examination of the evidence to see who's right. Impartial examination of the evidence? There is no such thing, as Dr. Van Til has shown us over and over again. The way in which you approach the evidence already reflects your worldview. Nietzsche had that same insight. He was saying the way in which philosophers argue is already an indication of what their view of reality is and their view of human nature. It reflects their preconceptions. And so objective truth, this is my third point, objective truth is a fiction. There is no objective truth, according to Nietzsche. The people who are pushing the rules of debate and rational engagement of hypotheses weighed by the evidence, these people who think they are being objective are really dull, uninspiring philosophers who are insecure and lazy. Ouch! There's the hammer. Boom! Nietzsche says, let's be honest about this, okay? When you guys go out there and you keep saying, let's be objective here, let's just look at the evidence, he says, that's just a reflection of your own dull lives. You're not passionate. You're afraid to show your commitments. You hide in your insecurity, your presuppositions, your preconceptions. You're basically lazy. You won't get out there and experience life and affirm yourself and create your own values. You let people drop values on you. You've gone to school and you've learned to imitate your professors. Whoa! Philosophers are not accustomed to being insulted like that. You're lawyers. You're paid to argue for your conclusions, and your objectivity is just a sign of your laziness and insecurity. Well, of course, in this sense, Nietzsche has real affinities, doesn't he, with Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard didn't want objective truth either. Of course, from Kierkegaard's standpoint, he didn't want objective truth because it's subjective commitment that's important. Nietzsche is much more radical. He says, there is no objective truth. Who do you think you're fooling? And it's in connection with this that he says, the falsity of a judgment is no objection to it. The falsity of an objection, excuse me, of a judgment, pardon me, the falsity of a judgment is no objection to it. What is important is not whether a judgment is true. What's important is whether it's life-affirming. And so what you have here is what's called an instrumentalist theory of truth. An instrumentalist theory of truth. What's important in our propositions is whether they are instruments for accomplishing what we want to accomplish. the affirmation of life. And so earlier when I was talking about thus spake Zarathustra, the overman is characterized by a will to power. He is going to create his own values. He asserts himself. That will to power is a basic drive behind all human endeavor, including philosophizing, Nietzsche said. And so he attacks traditional beliefs in a true or a real world. There is no true and real world. He attacks philosophers like Plato and Kant, who think they can be objective judges. Essentially, all of these dualistic outlooks between appearance and reality and the idea of an impartial judge trying to get behind the appearances to reality are life-denying. They are decadent and weak philosophies, according to Nietzsche. In fact, the reason philosophers endorse that approach is because they are using their pretense of objectivity as a way of dominating other people. Nietzsche said, here you have those who are physiologically weak and unable to get their way in society, luring people into the little game of objectivity so there they can dominate them by playing their mind games. Yeah, I'm telling, the hammer is really coming down hard. But isn't that an interesting insight? Where the philosopher gives the impression that we're going to get away from, you know, military conflict as a way of resolving this. Let's just come into the classroom or into the debate hall and objectively consider evidence and the truth. Nietzsche says, that's just your particular way of trying to dominate other people. Since you can't do it physically, you try to get them to, you know, give in to the notion of objective truth. And so now you can debate with them and get your way. So appeals to reason and to the truthfulness of judgments are just one of many means used by people where the will to power comes to expression, the way in which we try to exercise power over others. According to Nietzsche, all reasoning is rationalization. Every truth is nothing more than a perspective issuing from the will of the individual who's arguing for it. Since Nietzsche doesn't have any notion of objective truth, it shouldn't surprise you that he says the falsity of a judgment is no objection to it. What matters about your judgments or your propositions is not whether they conform to reality, of which there is no objective text anyway. It's not whether they conform to reality, but whether they are instrumental in accomplishing your desires, whether they are life-affirming for you. And so he says, there are no moral facts, but even in physics, he says, all of physics is interpretation and exegesis of the world to suit ourselves. Behind all, I'm quoting here, behind all logic and its seeming sovereignty of movement, there also stand valuations, or more clearly, physiological demands for the preservation of a certain type of life. So from Nietzsche's standpoint, what matters is not whether our propositions match some kind of objective truth. There isn't anything like that. What matters is whether our propositions are effective in accomplishing our ends. That scare you just a little bit? It's the end that justifies the means. If you get what you are trying to accomplish, then the proposition is quite acceptable. Whether it's true is irrelevant. And how can you deny him that conclusion if you grant him his assumption that in terms of the cognitive process, there is no objective truth anyway? Fourthly, with respect to our working out of Nietzsche's philosophy, He held to the artificiality and falsifying character of all language. I've already told you that all language, on his view, is interpretation, not, if you will, getting in touch with the original object of reality. But we need to realize that he thought language was falsifying in its character as well. Thinking is inseparable from language, according to Nietzsche, but language necessarily falsifies reality. And that's because through language we artificially order and simplify our raw experience. We have to do this in order to survive biologically. Nevertheless, our individual concepts and the structural features of our language by which we express them don't give us any genuine knowledge about the world as it exists apart from language. Everything in the world is seen, expressed, thought about through language, but it's artificial. And so somewhat like Henri Bergson, whom we will study in our 20th century lectures, like Bergson, Nietzsche conceives of reality as a kind of ineffable flux that can be trapped within the categorical net of language only at the expense of fatally distorting it. Reality is just this flux out there, so you throw the net of language out to catch some of the flux, but it's no longer flux when you do that. So your language necessarily distorts what reality is. And so it turns out that language and the world are incommensurable. You can't ever get the... When you use language, you're losing what the world is, what reality is. And so he wrote, and I quote, "A philosophical mythology lies hidden in language, which breaks through at every moment, no matter how careful we may be." The very use of language is already expressing a mythological, a philosophical mythology. So Nietzsche is not saying, be more careful. Make sure your evidence is objective. Watch the tools of reasoning. Clean them up. Be precise. Use language without ambiguity. He says, no matter how careful you are, language is going to be mythological in what it's expressing. It's going to distort reality. And this is what lies behind one of the famous aphorisms of Nietzsche that I appreciate. He said, "I fear that we still believe in God because we still believe in grammar." That's a brilliant insight. You know, and if you know much about my approach to defending the faith, presuppositional apologetics, Nietzsche is not sympathetic to that, but that's a great insight to an argument. Say, to the degree you hold to the objectivity of grammar, to that degree you need a Christian worldview. Nietzsche said, you can't hold that language has any objectivity, even grammar, because if you do, then you think that language is expressing reality. And you could only hold that view if you had a God. But what's Nietzsche's starting point? God is dead. Okay. This leads fifthly to Nietzsche maintaining the superiority of action and will over theorizing. Well, what have we just been saying for the last few minutes? All theorizing is elaborate rationalization of your will to power. So obviously, action. Assertion of your will is what's important. And in this, he has similarities to Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard doesn't respect rational theorizing, and he has affinities with Schopenhauer as well. Remember, Schopenhauer says, you get involved in trying to reason things through, that's an impediment to the assertion of your will. And that's what basic reality is, blind striving and will. And so Nietzsche does have these parallels with others that we can see. Well, sixthly, then, you can see if you follow these themes systematically, the conclusion you're going to come to is the will to power. That expression is Nietzsche's. He's well known for that. The will to power. Based on an evolutionary view of man, Nietzsche said man's basic drive is the will to be creative rather than merely to be a creature. The will to be creative rather than creaturely. God is dead. The Übermensch, the overman, is characterized by a will to power to become the creator of new values for himself. And so remember what I told you about thus spake Zarathustra. The contrast between the Superman, the Overman, and all the other slavish mentalities that are not self-affirming. And the last theme from Nietzsche that I want you to remember before I critique this is his doctrine of eternal recurrence. The doctrine of eternal recurrence. Nietzsche said there are vast cycles in history. History continues to repeat itself in very, very, very big circles. It takes a long time to come around, but all of history is cyclical. And the reason for that is that time is infinite, but there are only a limited number of possible conditions under which men can live. Since time goes on and on and on, but the conditions of life are finite, then they have to repeat themselves eventually. The doctrine of eternal recurrence. All right, so what should we say by way of response to Nietzsche? I have complimented him along the way for a number of kind of stinging insights and maybe even helpful aphorisms here and there. But in the end, we have to internally critique his own philosophy. Remember that Nietzsche valued creativity above being systematic. If you try to be systematic, that's a sign of weakness. What's important is creativity. Remember that he said there is no unchanging meaning. And that's why he could be deliberately ambiguous in the use of his language. He didn't hold to any objective, unchanging meaning. And I'm going to give you one of his famous aphorisms. In light of this derogation of being systematic and affirmation of being ambiguous, Nietzsche said, and I quote, "Every deep thinker fears being understood more than he fears being misunderstood." Every deep thinker fears being understood more than he fears being misunderstood. And the reason for that is, if you are understood, if you have this flattery that people understand what you're saying, then there is apparently some unchanging meaning. There is some kind of system, and you haven't been deliberately ambiguous enough. And as we've already seen, Nietzsche held there's only interpretations that are subjectively controlled. There is no original and unchanging meaning. There's only interpretations. Okay, I'm bringing all this together for you because this is the instrument of destruction that we're going to hammer back at him with. If that's true, then of course Nietzsche's attempt to genuinely communicate the truth to us, Nietzsche's attempt to be understood in what he was affirming, is inconsistent and futile on his own terms. Did Nietzsche want us to take his words as a text, as an original, or when we approach him, are we subjectively interpreting what he intended? By the way, in passing, it's of interest that Nietzsche has been assimilated to nearly every kind of conflicting philosophical outlook. I don't say that to his credit. I mean, even today, here I am, a Christian, I mean, from his standpoint, a slavish, fundamentalistic Christian, and I've been able to appropriate parts of what he has said. And just about every other school of philosophy has done the same thing, and there are many interpretations of Nietzsche. And so the point is, if what Nietzsche says is true, can there be objective truth? It can't be communicated. If what he says is true, why does he write philosophy at all? All language distorts. All theories distort. So why did he use language and have something of a theory to present to us? Apparently, Nietzsche's philosophy is the philosophy that destroys itself. That is the main criticism that I think we as Christians would direct to him, that if what he says is true, he can't say it. He has destroyed himself in trying to be a philosopher. The second thing that I'll note in quick passing is that this conceptual permissiveness that Nietzsche offers us, the falsity of a judgment is no objection to it. That permissiveness is utterly preposterous. If admittedly false propositions don't need to be rejected, then nothing is ruled out. I mean, we've given up the whole game of philosophy if we don't even distinguish between truth and falsity anymore and make truth what we should want and falsity something we should reject. Why philosophize at all if the falsity of a proposition is no objection to it? This conceptual permissiveness is just preposterous. All right, so I have criticized Kierkegaard, the subjective individualist. I've just finished my hammering back at Nietzsche, the nihilist. My last remark is by way of broad appreciation of something, though. There is still something in what these men offered to European culture and philosophy that I think is very important in the 20th century and accounts for their becoming popular after their lifetimes and not so much while they were alive. They correctly sensed something, although what they correctly sensed about our human condition was not appreciated until much later. They had a pessimistic view of human nature. They didn't explain it correctly. They had the wrong categories for it. We would call it sin. We would call it the fall. We would call it rebellion against God that creates alienation from our Maker and alienation with one another and even inner alienation. That's what sin is all about. Both Nietzsche and Kierkegaard had a sense of the fallenness of human nature. They didn't call it the fall, though. They didn't hold to the historical truthfulness of Christianity and account for it that way. But their notion of estrangement and alienation within human reality, their pessimistic view, if you will, of human nature, was the very opposite of that enlightenment confidence that man is perfectible, man is good, just get his reason operating properly and all of our problems can be dealt with. I find it interesting that an unbelieving philosopher like W.T. Jones, the set that I'm using to kind of structure my own presentations to you, not really sympathetic to Christianity. You read his treatment of Augustine, and you know, if you were in the class, I'd just, you know, go ballistic on the guy. I think he really messes up when he deals with Christianity. But even he has an appreciation for the fact that Kierkegaard and Nietzsche sensed there's something wrong in human nature. And I'd like to read just a little bit to you about that. Both of them, he says, were hostile to science as a cognitive enterprise and focused their attention on subjectivity, the subject. He says, in this one respect, they were part of the mainstream of Western thought, for interest in the self had been a characteristic of philosophy since Descartes. What was Descartes' starting point? I think, therefore I am. All right? My self-consciousness as a subject is the beginning point of all philosophy. I'm sure of myself, and then I bring God into the picture later. Well, I mean, we've come a long way from Descartes, but Jones does see this connection here. And not only of philosophy. Since the time of the Renaissance, the culture in all its aspects had been marked by an increasing attention to the subjective flow of experience. But whereas most philosophers, Kant and Hegel, for instance, had thought of the self chiefly as a knower, the philosophers of what he calls the counter-movement, what I have called the alternative access or the non-cognitivist approach, the philosophers of the counter-movement thought of the self as a decider and a chooser. They held that we become truly a self not in the neutral contemplation of a truth, but in the passionate commitment to a deed. Kierkegaard and Nietzsche are representative of this counter-movement. Both were born out of their time, when social and cultural conditions evoked neither sympathy nor understanding for their opinions. For many decades, Kierkegaard was hardly known outside of his native Denmark, and Nietzsche was easily written off as insane. But World War I, and to a greater extent World War II, drew men's attention forcefully to facts about human nature that earlier generations had ignored. The revelation of Nazi efforts to exterminate the Jews, the American atom bomb attacks on Japanese cities, the insanities of the Cold War, the callous injustice done to Negroes, the repeated failure to resolve conflicts by peaceful means, all these suggested that man is indeed as spiteful as Dostoevsky had declared him to be. In these circumstances, the dominant philosophy of reasonableness and progress began to appear naive. Almost two millennia earlier, Augustine had gazed into the mirror of self-knowledge and had found himself to be ulcerous, sinful, and corrupt. During the centuries of the Enlightenment, this view had been regarded not as a profound insight into human nature, but as a distorted perception of a neurotic mind. But when, in the early 20th century, men again experienced alienation and estrangement from their fellows and from the natural world, they began to regard Augustine as an unusually honest and perceptive psychologist. Even those men who were not by any means Christians came to share Augustine's and Paul's conviction that the human will is deeply divided and at odds with itself. Thus, in the aftermath of World War II, the time seemed increasingly out of joint, and men felt increasingly incapable of setting things right. At this point, they began to take seriously thinkers like Kierkegaard and Nietzsche. That comment on the history of philosophy, I mean, Nietzsche and Kierkegaard are the occasion of it, but that in itself is a thunderous, important thing for you to take into your thinking. Most philosophers don't want to look at, if you will, the fallenness of the subject who's doing the philosophizing. We just take it for granted that human nature is normal, that we're perfectly okay, and if we just rationally apply ourselves to the world, we can solve our problems. And that optimistic view of human nature is not possible. As Jones says, the tragedies of the 20th century have led us to say there's something seriously wrong inside here. Well, again, they didn't put it correctly. They weren't good theologians. But Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, in their own ways, realized that the subject of knowledge is off kilter, is out of center, is distorted in some way. It really takes a reading of the Bible to appreciate those insights and to make them accurate, because we have been trying to run from God. And the dreadful results of rebellion against our Maker are seen not just in the cultural problems of racism and war and poverty and all the rest. It's seen in that it finally destroys your intellect as well. The Apostle Paul said that those who will not submit to the preaching of the cross are made fools. And we want to thank our opponents, the Kierkegaards, the Nietzsches, and the W.T. Jones of this world, for being the ones to stand up and testify to the truth of what Paul taught us.